Okay. Parshas Mishpatim and Parshas Shkalim. Don't forget, we're starting a very exciting time of the year in which we orient and re-engineer our Kriyas HaTorah. Remind ourselves these are special times, and as we all experience, all excluding the Southern Hemisphere boys, but as we all experience in Yeshiva at least, the ability in the lifetime of an Oved Hashem to rise to the occasion, to experience special times through special experience and special energy and special dedication. It's a slow start. Obviously, Purim is 2 weeks away, 2.5 weeks away, and Pesach is a little bit more. And certainly, we want to already start to notice that some of these things are budding and emerging. And when we Parsha Shkalim, there's a sense, how can I renew the shekel, and how can I renew my energy, and certainly for the boys who have been here in a longer period, not to limp to the finish line, not to say, oh, there's only 2 weeks left till Purim, or 2 weeks after Purim to Poland, but to maximize time and energy and accomplishment, and just when you see boys returning from Sal, returning to the yeshiva, we're going to have one of these days, a special day of shiur. You're going to see a lot of people that are in officers training come back. I said, I miss yeshiva so much. I wish I could be in yeshiva. I pine and I yearn. I was talking to a boy today. He's going into the army in a few months. And I said, he's suffering some of the doldrums of winter's mom. And I said, don't you realize how much you'll long for these easy and tranquil moments of learning in yeshiva? So, and especially to the boys who are not staying a second year, for the boys again who have been here the entire year. So just realize that after Pesach, things move very quickly. And there's a lot of distractions after Pesach between Yom HaTzmaut, good distractions, Yom HaTzmaut, Yom Yerushalayim, Yom HaShoah, Shavuos, like Omer, and it tends to move very quickly. So as much as possible, as we get closer to the finish line, try to hold on to the time and try to maximize the experience, and you start at the basics, and then vision, inspiration, dreams, accomplishments start with day-to-day discipline and routine and adherence to schedule and performance and basic showing up, as we said so often, 90% of success in life is just showing up. So keep showing up and pushing yourself through whatever inclinations to distractions or to relaxation may come your way. If you're tired, you're not feeling well. Obviously, if you're seriously not feeling well, take care of your health and your long-term endurance. So, in the Neural Parshas Mishpatim, there's a little one pasuk right in between a section that describes the dinim of Shomrim, and sections which describe the laws of Mahashefa and various pagan culture practices. It's a very strange pasuk. I'm not going to discuss the placement of the pasuk per se, but a very interesting drasha surrounding the pasuk, which seems two drashas, which seem to be more iconic than literal. So one drasha, look at source number two or three. B'chol asher amarti alechem tishameru. A summarizing pasuk. Everything that I've mentioned, all these prohibitions, some of the prohibitions are iterated, I mentioned before, Machashefa lo sechaya. All the prohibitions, not just the prohibitions, but all the mitzvot sasei parshas mishpatim, the laws of Shomrim, the laws of Mazik, the laws of Baba Machteras, the laws of delivery, all these laws of Shem Marti Alechem Tishameru, you should guard them. Very strange conjugation. So Rashi cites one medrash. We'll discuss Rashi's medrash. And then on the back page, you can find a very different medrash, and we'll try to understand how this medrash views the pasuk. Rashi quotes the medrash, Michilta, Lasos kol mitzvos esei b'yazhara. By employing the term tishameru, and tishameru is one of the words that typically asserts a lav, tishamer, pen, the al are lavs. By using the word tishameru, the Torah overlays an isser on every mitzvah. Uvachol asher amarti alechem, tishameru. Rashi, lasos kol mitzvos esei b'yazhar. Shekol shmira shabatara azharahi b'makol lav. Are we to take this medrash literally? Every essay carries a lot. If I don't put on tefillin, I'm over an avera. I don't give tzedakah. Well, but tzedakah, there's a separate avera not to give tzedakah. And this is just a good time as any to mention that when an ani approaches you, you don't have the right to say no. You have the right to say not that much. But if an ani approaches you, and you have money, you may not have money, or you may not have money that you can break. You have 20 shekel, you need to get on a bus. You have 20 shekel, you need it for some very, very targeted purpose. But if you have money, and an ani reaches his hand and requests or solicits money, you have a mitzvah min hatara to give. Pasach tiftach yadcha lechicha laniacha, which is just as incumbent as a mitzvah tefillin. And if you say no, you may even violate the iser according to Sam Rishonim, by saying no. Now, you can give a shekel, a half a shekel. You don't have to give your life's fortune. Again, if you don't have money, look that person in the eye and just apologize nicely and kindly, which is half the time I don't have money with me. But so it means if you don't get sick, you may be violating an iser. But most mitzvahs lots, if you don't sit in the sukkah, you get an iser. If you don't eat outside of the sukkah. If you don't eat matzah, you get an iser. If you don't... What's the intention? What's the purpose of overlaying? It's not literal. It's not like every time you forego an opportunity to miss this essay, you violate a lotase. It must be more figurative. There's something about the experience of lotase that the Torah wants to infuse into the experience of Mrs. Essay. Something about lotase is valuable, and the Torah overlays it and inserts a lotase feel into the experience of a Mrs. Essay. V'chol asher amarti alechem tishameru, and not just essays in general, but somehow the essays of Parshas Mishpatim in particular. Why is this a location for this pasuk? And the answer is, somehow, when we come into contact with an iser, at some level we know we're encountering something which is dangerous to us. Sometimes we're able to identify that danger. Sometimes we're less able to identify that danger. But if Hashem forbade it, it's something which we sense viscerally, inherently, is out of bounds. It should be beyond any precinct of human interaction. Try to remember the last time you drank milk less than whatever fill in the blanks your minhag is after you had it. You just got like a little shock to your system. A little, something was off. And you realize it. That's not even deraisa. You're not eating milk and meat together. Or the last time, if it ever happened to you, that you ate something which you didn't know but had a hechsher. You thought it did and it didn't. Or the last time you committed an iser Shabbos, obviously unintentionally, whether it was the light switch or something. There's that moment when, and all of a sudden that, and you shifted and you felt, and some of it we understand, some of it we don't understand, but we realize that HaKadosh Baruch Hu creates a world of experiences, materials, and interactions that are dangerous and noxious to human experience. And by avoiding them, we elevate, we protect, we preserve, at the very least, our spirituality, perhaps even our physical nature. It's hard to know. Some of the things we do know, we don't know, but I imagine that if I placed a shellfish on the table right now in front of each of you, you'd recoil. There's something that would be very, very off and very jarring to the experience. And to a degree, in the world of mitzvah's essay, we don't always bring that same type of attitude. Sometimes our perspective on opportunity for mitzvah's essay is more characterized by, okay, I'll try my hardest, but if I don't, no pain, no gain, A for effort, put my best foot forward, all these cliches. And every time you meet a cliche, be careful if it's imprisoning capability, because it imprisons human experience because it cliches of human experience. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants to try to equalize the two. Not to create perhaps the same level of dread, maybe dread is too harsh a word, but I missed an opportunity for a mitzvah essay. Well, sometimes we have that. Like every once in a while you'll forget a marriage. And hopefully you'll wake up the next morning. And oh my goodness, I miss the marv. But that's because it's so hammered into our routine. We feel like almost as if our routine was set up. So we were sick that day. I missed the marv, and I have to repay the marv at the shulchan. But what about opportunities that aren't as overt and explicit, like missing a tefillah? What if you just missed an opportunity to perform a mitzvah essay? What if it's even more subtle than that? A day passed and you didn't maximize that day. Somehow you wasted your time. You spent several hours on the internet. Not just several hours, perhaps maybe several hours. Again, if you're watching things and seeing things that are inappropriate, you may violate an issue. But just wasting your time, idling your time. Are you able to recover and walk away with the same sense of loss, of trauma. Maybe it's too harsh a word. You shouldn't feel trauma at it, but maybe loss, and something has been lost. You could have accomplished something incredible and used your time in a productive fashion, whether it's studying or mitzvahs or just constructive time use, and that time basically disappeared and dissipated. It can never be recovered. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't want there to be two different polarities in Avodas Hashem. As if coming into contact with Allah, with Avodah Zarah, with Hashefa, with Basar Becholah, with Nevela, with Trefa, with Shellfish, with Blot, with Kelayim, if it thought you knew you were wearing Kelayim, you'd run out of here screaming, screeching. They say a story about Rav Moshe Feinstein, don't practice this at home. That having heard that he once drank, and he was, at least according to this story, there are other accounts, he was very makbid on basar stam, chalav stam, milk that wasn't chalav Yisrael, even though it had an hechsher, and he realized he had drank milk which wasn't chalav Yisrael, he immediately ran to the sink and forced himself to regurgitate the milk. I don't recommend that practice. Certainly not with chalav stam, which I drink very, very enjoyably. They tell a story about the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon once saw, some of you have learned the laws of Borer this year, the laws of Borer and Shabbos. So Borer becomes very tacky and very involved and complex when it comes to discarding shells and bones. That's why good Ashkenazi Jews found an end around. It's called gefilte fish. They grind and crush the fish, remove all of its bones, and make gefilte fish. And now you can find gefilte fish in the highest, high level restaurants, high cuisine. It's meant to be a Borer solution. It's not meant to be high cuisine. It's a Borer solution. These fancy restaurants, Shalom and gefilte fish. No, it's because of Bishul and Borer. It's not meant to be fancy food. But it just goes to show, if you wait long enough, everything will become retro. Don't let go of your old sneakers. One day you can sell them on eBay for a lot of money. So the Vilna Gaon saw someone at the table playing around with some shells or some bones. And he was just so horrified by the notion that he was watching an Isser Borer occur before his very eyes, or an Isser Muksa, perhaps, if the bones are Muksa, that he fainted. They quickly ran over to the Gaon, they revived him, but they had forgotten to remove the bones and the shells. So they revived him, and he fainted again. So finally, before the second revival, his rabbis had said, first get the bones, move the bones, now revive him. So I don't want to see anyone fainting or vomiting. These are very, very extreme, radical responses for people whose lifestyles mirror that. So much of religion is about natural and organic expression, not unnatural and asymmetric. One of the great stories about Rav Amital, just to show you how different stages and levels and forms of behavior are appropriate for different people. There's a machlokis in Shulchan Aruch about whether your yotzei tzitzis, if you don't wear wool tzitzis. Let's say the baggage you're wearing is made out of cotton. Are you yotzei? It's a machlokas rishonim. By the way, now's a good time, especially for the people who have just joined yeshiva, and it's only for people that haven't thought that much about this yet, to remind you about this is a mitzvah that basically it's a freebie. Every second you're wearing tzitzis, you're yotzei mitzvah. Don't take any effort, any toil, any commitment, any energy, just simply wearing tzitzis. And to me, it's really a barometer of how you view religion, because in theory, you can get away with it, or wag your fingers, and I'm not wearing a four-quarter beged. Is that your attitude towards mitzvahs? Do you want to buy in or buy out? Are you trying to get away with as little as possible? And that could be very, very telling and formative in terms of religious identity. Do I see religion as something just to check a box and make sure I'm not doing anything wrong while I pursue my other ambitions? Or religion is really, it's a good orientation. I just finished a lot of interviews. Tomorrow's officially acceptance day for the North American interviewees. Heads will roll tomorrow. Anyway, there's blood in the streets. So a lot of times boys ask me, what's the purpose of yeshiva? I come from a firm home. I hope to be from. I say, well, in many cases, obviously there isn't a standard answer, but it's a nice question to ask as you're starting your first month or beginning your first month in yeshiva. For many boys and girls and youngsters, religion is on the back burner. It doesn't occupy their primary passion, the primary focus. What I want to do in life, profession, and family, and enjoy life, and advance. Of course, I'm Jewish. That's how I was brought up and from. So I want to make sure I attend to all the details and conform to all the expectations. And yeshiva is similar to taking that pot and moving it from the back burner to the front burner. this is what really interests me. I live to be a religious person, to engage in a relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to study his will, to perfect his world, to live his history, to change his people, to... And it all makes sense, and it all fits, and it all is integrated with that. But when you wake up in the morning, you're excited to be religious. Is that something? And if the answer is no, don't get freaked out. That's why you're here in Yeshiva. You've been here for a month. Don't expect the answer to be yes. Be honest with yourself, but at least try to establish the target. That's my target, to be an Oved Hashem, and everyone will define that slightly differently. So since this is a very good barometer as to how you view religion, am I interested in the less, as less as possible, least as possible, or to try to buy in as much as possible? Anyway, getting back to that story, someone entered Rav Amital's car taking a trip. And the Shulchan Aruch happens to paskin that you can be yotze with cotton tzitzis. By the way, just for those of you who may or may not be aware, fish tzitzis is not so clear. It's a machlokas between Rav Moshe Feinstein and Rav Avi Yosef. So do the math and look it up. It's not so clear you can be yotze with fish tzitzis because it's processed plastic rather than an actual garment, an actual textile-based garments. So anyway, so yes, Rav Amital, the Shulchan Aruch paskins that you can wear cotton tzitzis, but he does add the following line. A Yirei Shamayim should wear wool tzitzis. And by the way, just a little word for those who may be interested in wool tzitzis. First of all, now's the time to try it out. Don't wait for the summer. Good time to try it out if you want to experiment with it. That'd be a really good day today. Second of all, it's not as bad as it looks. After a while, you get used to it. The wool gets really silky and you don't really notice. It's not really a big difference. Once in a while, I wear a cotton pair of tzitzis. I don't have them anymore, but I'll put it on, it just doesn't make much of it. Don't get all, not a big deal. It doesn't, even in the summer, it doesn't really change your habits that much. Just for those who may feel that, my goodness, what am I going to become? My whole life will be different. It's pretty easy, mitzvah, mekayim, l'chalashit, also. But anyway, getting back to that story, so he asked Rav Amital, the Shulchan Aruch writes, Yirei Shamayim should wear wool tzitzis. Should I wear wool tzitzis? So Rav Amital told him, you're reading that Shulchan Aruch differently from the way I'm reading it. You're reading the Shulchan Aruch, if you want to be a Yirei Shamayim, put on wool tzitzis. I am reading it, if you are a Yirei Shamayim, wear wool tzitzis. It's a big difference. He was reading it, here's my quick fix. My fast, rapid rise to become a Yirei Shamayim. I don't have to work on Kibbutz Avayi, that's difficult. Talmud Torah, that's minyan, chesed, midos, kavanah and benching, kavanah and brachos. That route towards Yirei Shamayim, that's strenuous, that's arduous. I want the easy pass. I want the quick express lane. I want to put on wool tzitzis and become a Yirei Shamayim. And inherent within that is maybe until you work on some of the other areas of life, perhaps you shouldn't preen around in religious postures that don't necessarily match your religious stature or station. Some people would argue it could be a catalyst, it could be an inducer. But there may be some models of behavior that are appropriate for some, or at some stages that are appropriate. So for example, Moshe Rabbeinu has to separate from his wife because he has to be in a constant state of readiness to receive the Dvar Hashem. Anyone other than Moshe who would separate from their wife, that would be ugly. That would be inappropriate. It would be just off. So there may be a level of conduct that's appropriate for Moshe, but extreme is not appropriate for everyone else. And within that group of the non-Moshes, there are certain types of conduct that are appropriate for some people, not for others. What's appropriate for a boy who's 18 or 19 years old? Perhaps playing sports healthily, eating healthily, engaging in forms of recreation, releasing some of the steam and pressure that gets built up, that may not be appropriate for 35-year-olds. So some of the guidance we're giving you is you have to live within your shell. You have to live within your current frame of mind and placement, because if you try to live realities that aren't yours, it doesn't work. Hashem creates a natural rhythm for life, and natural rhythms at 18 and 19 may be different from natural rhythms later on in life, and also within marriages. There are certain things that are natural to marriages, to at a certain stage of the marriage, and unnatural to marriage is a later stage of the marriage. So a lot of it is timing and appreciating. So that's, I think, why the Torah wants to overlay a low kase for a kase. To be able to create that same sense of urgency and compulsion and care. And I've told you several times this year, from time to time, it's very healthy to conduct the Cheshbon HaNefesh, not just to wait for Shana Yom Kippur, perhaps on a weekly basis, bi-weekly, at very least monthly. How have I performed the last month? And the answer can't just be, I didn't violate any of the arrows, and I didn't eat any non-kosher. And it can't just be, I've made beachhead. I'm keeping my head above water. I fulfilled all my obligations and requirements. But where am I heading? Am I maximizing my time usage? Am I becoming a kinder person? Am I changing as a person? These are healthy checks that prevent us from settling into ruts and becoming inert or stagnant. Rashi quotes a different issue. Let's take a look at Rashi. Rashi says, Lama Nemar, source number 3, part Gimel in the back. Lama Nemar, why does it say, V'chala Sher Amarti Alechem Tishameru? Medishu Amar V'samtas HaShulchan. Very strange non sequitur, but we will study Emirat Hashem and Truma about the Shulchan and its positioning. Im Shina, if you change the location of the Shulchan, over below Lotase, you're over Lotase. Talk about odd midrashim. A pasuk in Mishpatim instructs us not to alter the location of the Shulchan. Now, how Chazal associate this pasuk with the Shulchan is a different matter, but what's the message behind a pasuk in Mishpatim warning us about the location of the Shulchan? When I say the word Mishkan, Shulchan, Lechem Hapanim, Kohen, Beis HaMikdash, your mind immediately careens to very high-minded concepts of religion, of symbolism, of interaction with Hashem. If I offered you Kohanim, not non-Kohanim, some Lechem HaPanim tonight for dinner, it would be Aser because it's outside of Beis HaMikdash, but let's say we found a special heter. And through one door you could access Lechem HaPanim, and through the other door you'd eat falafel and french fries. Who wouldn't run through the Lechem HaPanim door? Don't answer the question. Okay, Lechem HaPanim from Burger's Bar with a burger. Okay, now we're leveling the playing field. A Burger's Bar with Lechem HaPanim. I'll take the Burger's Bar without Lechem HaPanim. Could you imagine eating the bread of a Kodesh Baruch Hu Lechem from the Beis HaMikdash? I could violate one act as a czar and be a quasi-kohen and eat Lechem HaPanim. Such incredible values and concepts. And the Shulchan, gold-plated with rods and levels and shelves and spices, Lavona. Does it really make a difference whether the Shulchan is 2 inches to the left or 2 inches to the right? That's religion? Something so epic, dramatic, surpassing in its imagery. Makes a difference, such picayune details. A little to the left, a little to the right. So the Torah stresses, and I'll mention in a few moments why specifically in Parshas Mishpatim. Listen carefully. This is a cliche that I'm shattering. God is in the details. God is not just in these broad concepts of religion, morality, society, history. Hashem really cares, guys, listen carefully, whether I put the kugel on the hot plate this way on Shabbos, I put the kugel on the hot plate that way on Shabbos? Yes. Okay, the hot plate maybe is exaggeration, it's probably different sheet. But yes, Hashem cares whether you heat kugel on Shabbos on a fire or heat it on a fire which is garfa katan, which is cover. And in the modern context, that's very, very discordant. It's very unfamiliar. For people to articulate religion in such a detailed and specific fashion rather than as a broad system of values to govern and to inspire human experience. And it's precisely the detailed nature of Judaism and of Avodas Hashem that renders it so durable and so anchored. Because if religion is relegated to an abstract set of ideals, it can be confined to Sunday mornings in the church. And it can lead to the type of religious schizophrenia that we sometimes witness, which is, of course, the first stage towards religious collapse. Religious in the church, metaphorically, because I tend to the values that are espoused. But the power of religion is to sense the presence of a Kodesh Baruch Hu in every nook and cranny of human experience. Those that are governed by halacha, those that aren't governed by halacha. Halacha teaches us the modality of life. If I leave Hashem's presence through these details of human experience, how I eat and how I prepare food and how my Shabbos works and how I marry and how I cut from the field and how I harvest. It teaches me that even when I'm not living through halachic lenses, I'm living in the presence of the Ribono Shel Olam. Hashem is not in Shemayim articulating general values that govern experience in a general abstract fashion. But I can encounter HaKadosh Baruch Hu in every single moment of human experience through halachic prisms and interfaces, if they're not halachic prisms and interfaces. Prepare yourself, almost inoculate yourself, because this type of attitude not only will it not be supported or reinforced in your broader experiences as a member of the millennial generation, but it will be scoffed at, it will be mimicked. That's what religion is about. Religion is about morality and saving the planet and hugging the whales and world peace and digging ditches for the underprivileged. And quite frankly, in answer to Nati's question, Nati's not here now, but he asked the question at the Tish and Svat, why is Lamda so important and how do you feel HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence when you delve into such categorizations and understanding the word of Hashem in such slight analyses or differentiations. And part of it is just training our mind that this is all the Dvar Hashem, and it's just as important as a piece in the Mar Nevuchim or a quick statement about the cosmic harmony or about, and they're both real, they're both meaningful, and they both matter. And when you're reading a very, very limited, so to speak, a line of limited horizons in the Shach, you're seeing Hashem's world in the same resplendent universal sense as when you're discussing a Ramban al-Atar or a Ramban whose horizons are by definition more panoramic because it's all integrated, because Hashem's knowledge is all integrated logic, it's all integrated to the Hashem. And it's specifically the Shulchan that would excite such associations, that would invite such carelessness. It's the Shulchan. Who cares? And to a degree, in the same thing in Parshas Mishpatim, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu is detailing the type of society you're meant to construct. This is not just specific, isolated laws of Evid Ivri, or of Ganav, or of Shamrin, but we're aiming to create a just, stable, governed society. This is our chance to show humanity the effects, and the ennobling effects of Torah, that we can create a society that respects and imposes rule of law, and protects the weak against the exploitations of the strong, and protects the vulnerable people most. And that's why Evid Ivri is spoken about first, because Evid Ivri, remember, we don't live in a slave environment anymore, so for us it doesn't resonate, but it's only recently that slavery was abolished. Slavery was more dominant in human history than you assume it was, because Baruch Hashem, we don't live in a world characterized by slavery. People were sold into slavery, were born into slavery, lived generations upon generations as slaves, and they're vulnerable to the whims of society, to the caprice of their masters, and Judaism carefully regulates. It admits that there's going to be a phenomenon called slavery. It's unavoidable based on the financial incapacities of people. Baruch Hashem, we've created welfare situations and welfare deliveries to protect against that, so someone doesn't have to sell himself into slavery. But being that an ancient society or something which is not just tolerable, but a latent part of our social experience, has to be carefully governed. And the dangers and excesses of injustice and abuse are carefully restrained and carefully limited by the Torah. So you think there's a larger aim here. There's a larger purpose. Crafting a state of social justice and social equality and moral well-being. And does it really make a difference how I construct the contract, or whether you're Shomer Chinam or Shomer Sachar, or whether you pay Kefal or Dalet Vehei, or if it's a Shor? After all, there's a larger score, there's a larger agenda. And that larger agenda should be severed or independent, should be granted autonomy from details. The answer is that if you're creating a state or a society crafted in the image of Hashem's moral impulse, the moment you deviate from Hashem's will is the moment you become unanchored from the source of that moral flow. You're trying to create the image of a society in Hashem's image, and you think, of course, that there's an overlap between Hashem's moral will and human morality. Of course there is. But our moral sweep is not capable of deciding every single detailed application, and therefore we have to follow very carefully, adhere very carefully. And again, for much of Jewish history, this is all academic and theoretical. We don't yet have, we're not yet at the stage of history we can craft a society based on Shemachina and Shemachar and contracts and Ghana. And it's been Zelcha, but Mirat Hashem, we're veering closer and closer. When Mashiach comes, Mishpatim will become relevant, not just in the academic sense, to understand the role of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but perhaps practically. Maybe there won't be Shomrim, but we'll have to establish constructs of human experience and of law. And they're very similar. There are people that are already starting to think this way. I was quoted a few years ago, one of my articles in Gemara was quoted by a Supreme Court justice in Israel. Again, just wasn't a direct one-to-one, therefore we should rule this way, but he was giving a little background information upon the case. He wanted to show that this is something that's very deeply rooted in Jewish experience. And there are lawyers who are beginning to think in these terms, not just in Israel, not just Jews. Let's look back to biblical law and to Talmudic analysis and try to get a sense of how we should craft our verdicts and how we should build a judicial system or how we should create law in the modern context. It's a very interesting pasuk. It stands out. Rashi cites one version of the Medrash to create that sense of urgency, not just for violation, but for opportunity. Not just for infraction, but for missed opportunities, whether there are specific mitzvos esse, opportunities for constructive religious or moral behavior that are simply ignored or forfeited. The Medrash that Rashi doesn't quote talks about the details of the Shulchan being important. Again, how Chazal bridged between Parshas Mishpatim and the Shulchan, not exactly clear from this Medrash, but it's an important message that details in Halacha do matter. Don't get me wrong. Some people today become too immersed in the details. We had a word for those people in Yeshiva. People who worship the Shulchan Aruch but fail to worship HaKadosh Baruch Hu. They meticulously adhere to every single detail in halacha. Some would say to the point of passion, others would call it an obsession, that's already a judgment call, but they're very meticulously adherent. But somehow you get the sense that the relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the broader sense is either absent or flawed. Sometimes we find people who act in ways that violate basic moral sensibilities and even halacha, but they exhibit, I don't call them orthodox, they exhibit, we won't call someone, oh, he's orthodox, but he's violent Shabbos. When you violate Shabbos, you're not an orthodox person. Same way someone who wantonly steals and betrays or deceives people in stock market schemes, we'll say, oh, he's frum, he's not frum. I mean, obviously you're frum if you buy and you try your hardest, but that's a glaring flaw in your frum, just like Shabbos is a glaring flaw in your frum. You won't call people who are child abusers, oh, but he's frum, he's not frum. Again, frumkeit doesn't mean you succeed at everything. Frumkeit means you try your hardest. If someone's trying their hardest, then they're frum. It's people who just wantonly and simply uncaringly, carelessly, just not carelessly, but in a direct voluntary sense, violate areas of halacha just because it doesn't suit their interests. That's not frumkeit. It's not that you have people, and that's the danger. If for you it's all just adhering to the laws and worrying about meeting every single requirement that every single isser and every single mitzvah, without building that overall fabric of religious meaning and relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu and the purpose of religion, the purpose of Avodas Hashem, and it's about that balance and learning to practice halacha in a very, very detailed. Baruch Hashem, most of you grew up in an environment in which you rarely have to ask halacha questions. Kashrus today, you don't have to ask many questions. Shabbos today, you don't have to ask many questions. Our societies and our families have built basically halacha-free environment. Not halacha-free, but halacha. You don't have to ask questions. Shabbos is Shabbos. Making Shabbos today is almost, you can perform it blindly. Keeping kashrus, you just go to the kosher stores. I had a friend who was once a rabbi friend. He told me that 99% of his questions come on Erev Pesach. And of those questions, 99% of the questions which come on Erev Pesach, which comprise 99% of the questions he feels the entire year, 99% of the questions in Erev Pesach are, does Coke have a Hakshul Pesach? I drink Coke on Pesach. Just today, you don't have to know Smicha, you just have to have a good secretary to call. You know, you have a hotline there, you just know what's kosher, what's not kosher. But as you leave the cocoon of your homes and your communities, even for temporary stages, you have real halacha questions. And that's, to me, a halachic moment. Someone with halachic fidelity learns how to ask questions. And today, with social media, questions and Rabbanim and Poskim are immediately available. Just this week, I got two questions on Facebook. Just two very quick questions. Very simple questions. One was by a 45-year-old Talmud of the Yeshiva. One was by, must be in his mid-30s. Simple little questions. Rabbi, can I ask you a quick question? And some people don't have that level of halacha commitment. Let's just let it fly or let it roll. And It's about training yourself. Again, not to ask obsessive questions. I've heard people that ask questions that are relevant. Rabbi, can I, it's not a halachic question. But when you know you're bordering or encountering halachic issues, and if you don't know, ask. There's nothing to be embarrassed with. It doesn't show obsessiveness. It shows real halachic care and real halachic interest in my keeping. Again, that's the point. Religion's not about keeping all the rules. It's only that, but it's certainly also about that. Okay, let's take a look at part number one. Part number one talks about a pasuk that appears in the end of Parshas Yisro that I didn't quote, so I apologize. I was preparing these a little quickly today. The last pasuk in Parshas Yisro talks about a ramp as opposed to stairs. Who remembers the pasuk? V'lo saleh b'ma'alos al mizbechi asher lo tigalar v'schalav. You shouldn't run up the stairs of the mizbech, you should have a ramp. So the mizbech has a kevesh rather than stairs, or as they say in Hebrew, a rampa. You don't know that term, rampa? All too well, Rabbi. All too well. Don't remind me. Okay. I also used to sit on the rampa of the yeshiva. A rampa literally means a ramp. There used to actually be ramps leading up there. The rampa changed in the late 80s. They used to have a different settlement, the base medrash, whatever, dish history. Anyway, the mizbech doesn't have stairs. If it had stairs, the kohanim could leap up those stairs. Had a ramp, it's harder to quickly accelerate upon a ramp. You have to walk more gradually. The reason the Torah gives for a ramp as opposed to stairs seems very pragmatic. The kohanim, if they run and jump stairs, the bottom hems of their pants or their cloaks, they fly in the wind or flap in the wind, and you'd see their skin. Which, again, in most cases, is no big deal. You'd see the bottom of their legs, maybe their leg. But in the Beis HaMikdash, there's a level of decorum that perhaps is more sensitive and more saintly and more appropriate. They're very, very lax, so to speak, on the dress code in yeshiva. But again, it won't be appropriate now, but a person will come to the Beis Medrash wearing shorts. We don't, well, it's not the way you behave in a Beis Medrash. Is anything wrong with wearing a pair of shorts? No, when you're Beis Medrash playing sports, when you're lounging at home, when you're going to sleep, if it's a summer day, there's nothing wrong. But walking to the Beis Medrash, you're standing in front of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Remember, tznius is not only for women, and it's not only about how you dress. The core of tznius is to know that you're in the presence of Hashem. That's what tznius is. To know that you're in the presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And if you have that abiding sense, then you're a tzinoah, and therefore you're not going to be flamboyant and project yourself in ways that would be inappropriate. Ask yourself, as I would always ask myself, would I do this if I'm looking to see anyone in the room? Now, certain things I wouldn't do because I feel there's a certain level of decorumfies there, but there's always that sense that that's what Sneha says. Hashem's in the room, and therefore I have to be careful about the way you speak and the way you behave. And again, it's not like you check every level of behavior at a time, but you create an awareness and a mentality and a rhythm that takes into account Hashem's presence. One aspect of tznius is how you dress, and that aspect of tznius is a little different for women than it is for men, because the female body was created in a way that creates a sexual attraction. But we make a mistake as communities when all tznius is just about how long hemlines are. It applies to men as a just as women. So if you're walking to the Beis Medrash a short zone, that's not tznius, not because of the skin, it's because it's inappropriate. Things that call attention to yourself are inappropriate. Sometimes when people let their hair grow very, very long, unless there's some other alternative reason, of course, if the person is trying to grow hair for cancer victims, obviously, that's a mitigating factor. The person's a nazir, obviously the mitigating factor. But it just draws attention to yourself, and the person shouldn't try to draw undue attention. You shouldn't be trying to grab headlines and people's attention. All of a sudden, everyone's walking more across the room. Everyone has a more or less a similar haircut. It's not like I'm stopping and looking at you. They're all more or less dressed the same, looking the same. But all of a sudden, your hair is combed in a certain fashion. And certainly, if it's done for that reason, if a person is unaware, okay, they may be unaware. If they ask me, why shouldn't the rabbi say for that reason? But a person dresses that way to grab attention, that's a lack of tznius. And you can have your entire body covered. You're just not a tzinoah. You shouldn't be drawing attention to yourself in a disproportionate fashion. You just go with the flow. Be someone that's more or less like everyone else. But yet it's juxtaposed to the first pasuk in Parshas Mishpatim. Ve'ela mishpatim asher tosim lefneihem. So Chazal sense But there's a common message between Kohanim not running up the Mizbeach and between a deliberate form of judiciary activity. Source number one. Maksiv l'malam in inyan. This is a medrash. V'lo saleh b'malos al mizbechi. The last pasuk in Yisrael about not running up the Mizbeach. The first pasuk in Mishpatim, ve'el mishpatim. V'chima inyan zeh etzel zeh. This is the most important question in all of Torah. Unnatural associations. Things that don't seem to be juxtaposed logically, and they're yoked together unnaturally. They're yoked together because the Torah wants to make a point. They're placed side by side. V'chi ervasan shal konim ha'isim agula. Who cares? The konim really care that konim's legs are uncovered. They had long pants. They had a long frock. At least the Kohen Gadol did. We're really concerned. Ella Amar Ravina, line number three. The Mizbeach, non-running on the Mizbeach, is not just about uncovering body parts. Kishem Shehizira HaKadosh Baruch Hu Es HaKonim Shelo Yuposim Pesiyos Gassos Lega Mizbeach. Just think the Konim can't run off the Mizbeach. Ella Yumahalchen Eki Besad Gadol. They have to walk up slowly and gradually. Just like the Konim can't take large steps. Kach Hizir HaKadosh Baruch Hu Es HaDayanim. The Dayanim also can't take large steps. Shelo Yafsil Pesiyos Gassos Badin. What does it mean for Dayanim to take quick steps? It means to be hasty in judgment. It means to move quickly as you process a case, as you adjudicate a situation. Have a Misuna Madin, the first mission in Pirkei Avos. Be deliberate when you judge people. Be temperate. Think. Analyze. Don't reach hasty, impetuous, quick, snap decisions. Don't take Pesiyos Gassos. Don't leap three stairs at a time. Don't be quick to judge. Well, of course, when Chazal say having mesunim badin, they're not just referring to formal judges on a tribunal. Whenever the Torah talks about mishpat, it's talking to the people that judge each other every day. We all sit in judgment upon each other, as we should. We look at the people in our lives, we look at their lifestyles, and we assess whether they're appropriate, whether we want to emulate, whether we want to copy them. That's how we build identity. Right now, that's why you're in yeshiva. You're meeting people. You're rendering judgment. You're learning. You're exposing yourself to other people. And you're saying, is this the value I want to absorb and inculcate? But there's a difference between judgment and judgmentalism. Judgment is when you carefully regard lifestyle, behavior. Judgmentalism is when you brand people based on quickly assessing their behavior without understanding its context, its background, its positive ramifications. So when the Torah tells us not to be hasty in judgment, not to run up the Mizbeach, or not to be hasty in judgment like those Kohanim leaping up the Mizbeach, the Torah is telling us be careful about how you judge people. Are you able to see the entire person? Are you able to see the context? Able to people in a balanced fashion. Those are talents that you have to build over the course of a lifetime. People take great comfort in stigma and stereotype because it substitutes for learning about people and thinking carefully. We can just brand people based on their ideology, based on the way they dress, based on the way they look, based on their skin color. It acquits us. We live in a very fast-paced world in which you don't necessarily have the time to deliberate and to contemplate and to process. So we have to, or at least there's a temptation to reach very quick judgments about people. Ask yourself the following question. When's the last time you misjudged someone? When's the last time you reach a very quick judgment about someone based on, whether it could be an irrelevant factor that I mentioned before, dress or skin color, even the fact that you saw them behave in a certain way, you just assumed and you connected the dots and you associated freely, and then you got to know that person a little bit better. This is obviously inevitable. When I walk away from a Levaya, even if someone that I didn't know, and I'm just attending the Levaya out of respect for the person, for the family, I just walk away with a sad sense that here's a world that departed, and I never really knew that world. I just heard about that person a few times, but I just had been more attentive and more inquisitive and learn more about that person. It's such great values, such great dedication, such great behavior. I could have learned so much more, and I didn't. That's the tragedy of life, and life with limited resources available for enrichment and for growth, because only so much you can absorb and so much you can process. And that's really, boys, listen carefully, the core of this association. The same danger that may seduce the Kohen to run quickly up the Mizbeach may seduce people to become judgmental when they're judging, not just officially, but interactively. What's that danger? What's that common danger? Listen carefully. It's called religious passion. Religious passion is dangerous? I spent the whole year trying to kickstart it. Why do you think the Kohanim are running up the Mizbeach? Because they're exercising? They're practicing their long jump? Why would there be a danger of Kohanim running up the Mizbeach if there were stairs instead of a ramp? Because they're excited. Because they're thrilled at the notion that they can serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu. They're not walking, they're running. And Hashem says, wait a second, slow down. Walk up gradually, like I said before. Religion in stages. Don't try to bite off more than you can chew. Don't let religious passion to run up too quickly on the Mizbeach. Sometimes you'll put one foot in front of the other inappropriately. You'll put stage B, stage A instead of stage B. You'll reorder the sequencing. That same danger is what really renders us judgmental about others. Because if you're really serious about religion, and I hope you are, you'll feel very deeply about your Avodas Hashem. About the way you learn, the yeshiva you learn in, and the rebbes who teach you, especially the Wednesday night rebbe teaches. You'll feel, wow, that's an incredible approach. Incredible shir, it's an incredible derech. And then you'll look to the person to your right, and his derech may be a little different. And then you look at the boy in the other yeshiva, his derech may be a little different. They look at a different community, and their derech may be a little different. And then you look at people who aren't so successful in Avodas Hashem, in some cases through no fault of their own. And the same emotions which flare and excite you about religion will now be vented in a very negative and dismissive way. It's inevitable. If you really love your Avodas Hashem, then it's hard then not to feel disdain for those who don't feel that same love. So the same danger that may cause the Kohen to run too quickly up the Mizbeach may also cause you to be judgmental about other people, not only other Jews, but other people. And that's why the Torah juxtaposes. It's so hard. See, people who avoid this are people who are trapped in a very dark world called PC, politically correct. We can't render judgments about anything or anyone. And the danger of absolute non-judgmentalism is the lack of any passion, any belief in anything. It's the erosion of all value and simply falling into a swirl of moral relativism. And that's in many cases where society feels itself careening toward, and many people feel like backlash. What makes Trump so popular? Because they're anti-PC. He's going to say whatever he wants and insult anyone. People sense, oh, but this is true. This is passion. This is belief. These are values. This is conviction. Everything else is just emulsification and the application of any value system. And the sweet spot is to try to carefully calibrate between feeling passion deeply for something and then allowing something called ration to impede or to block the judgmentalism. Let me give you an example. It's going to sound ridiculous, but it's all the same. And you'll laugh at it, but if you just play this exercise in your mind, you'll be able perhaps to be passionate about something without being judgmental or dismissive or reductive of people whose passion is expressed a little bit differently. I love vanilla ice cream. I love it. I can eat it right now, as cold as I am. I despise chocolate ice cream. You couldn't pay me enough to eat chocolate ice cream. I don't know why. But
Can I imagine people loving chocolate ice cream? Like, in my wild, can I imagine the people that may love something I don't love? Pretty much. There's a very, 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 very lucrative industry out there called chocolate ice cream. Does it make me love vanilla ice cream less? No, just this is my taste, this is my flavor in that person. And be careful, this can lead to absolute pluralism and everything goes. But a set of values we believe deeply in. Are you able to bring that same approach in various stages? Most compellingly to your avodas Hashem, I love my derech, I love learning Gemara this way, I love serving Hashem, I love this Yishai, I love this derech, this Masar I have. And the people who see Hashem a little bit differently. They're wired differently. And their access to their bonus shalom is a little bit different from mine. I can understand that. We're able to bring... Okay, and then what about people who aren't firm? Okay, I love the fact that Hashem chose me. And I've been able to maintain my halachic fidelity throughout history. My parents, my grandparents, able to maintain my orthodoxy. Well, my father was a Baal Teshuva and he brought me back. And unfortunately, there's some people who... lost that tradition, no fault of their own in particular. Or some people have very, very difficult stages in life that force them to walk away in ways that I don't endorse or validate, but I can't judge a person. It's hard for that person. The person went through a lot, went through very difficult times. And are you able to bring that duality where you feel, for some people, they're not able to feel the passion because they're so intent on non-judgment and not rendering dismissive comments about people. It's painful to see the erosion of passion and conviction wrought by a hyper-PC world. And can you find that middle space where you're so committed and so passionate and so dedicated to ideas, but it doesn't translate into being judgmental or offensive or in any way trivializing of other people and the value of their lives? And that's what the Torah seeks to convey by this juxtaposition. It's the same danger. It's not just the same phenomenon. It's the same shiny metal object. It's the same genie. Not just like you don't run up the Mizbeach and take Pesilos Gassos, you shouldn't take Pesilos Gassos as a judge or as a judger of people. It's the same danger. What is calling the coin? Religious passion. Don't run. Walk. What is calling judgmentalism? Religious passion. I believe in this so deeply. It strikes at the core of my being. How do I balance that and create a system or calibration that I believe deeply, but I don't incinerate people around me, dismiss, disrespect those in my orbit? I'm an embracing person that respects others without it eroding the integrity of my own experience. That's the challenge of this juncture between Parshas Yisro and Parshas Mishpatim.